Welcome to Layer Zero. Layer Zero is a podcast of unscripted conversations with the people that make up the Ethereum community. Crypto is built by code, but it's composed by people, and each individual member of the community has their own story to tell. Cypherpunks understood that the code they write impacts the people that use it, and Layer Zero is a podcast that focuses on the people behind the code because Ethereum is people all the way down, and it always has been. Today, I'm talking with Peter Pan, who is a fellow class of 2017 crypto person, got into the world of crypto around the same time I did, made similar typical newbie mistakes that one does, buying XRP. But Peter immediately injected himself right into the core of the Ethereum community and kind of led the charge for DAOs. He was one of the earliest DAOers to really kind of reinvigorate this whole DAO revolution, starting, I think, in maybe early 2019. Peter's legacy, along with others as well, is MetaCartel. MetaCartel was the first DAO after Moloch DAO to really use the dope Moloch framework and to try and bestow part of what its visions should be upon the world via funding grants. But it's really turned into much, much more than that. I think MetaCartel is... it's a meme that is also a public good, kind of. It's a vibe that we all, as a collective humanity, can tap into. Defining MetaCartel, I think, is inherently impossible. But I think you will, as a listener, understand why after you listen to this conversation with Peter Pan. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get right into that conversation. But before we do, a moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible.
Bankless is proud to be supported by Uniswap. Uniswap is a new paradigm in asset exchange infrastructure. Instead of a cumbersome order book system where trades are matched with other humans, Uniswap is an autonomous piece of software on Ethereum, which is what Ryan and I call a money robot. No human counterparties or centralized intermediaries, just autonomous code on Ethereum. Input the token you want to sell and receive the token you want to buy. Something brand new in the Uniswap ecosystem is the Uniswap Grants program is now accepting applications for grants. We have been saying this for a while and we'll say it again. DAOs have money and they are in need of labor. If you think that you have something to contribute to the Uniswap DAO, apply for a grant to Uniswap. Just look at the size of the Uniswap treasury. It's almost $3 billion. This mountain of capital is looking for labor. Do you have something of value to contribute to the Uniswap DAO? No matter how big or small your idea is, you can apply for a Uni grant at unigrants.org and help steer Uniswap in the direction that you think it should go. That's exactly what we did to get Uniswap to be a sponsor for Bankless, and you can do the same for your project. Thank you, Uniswap, for sponsoring Bankless. The era of proof of stake is upon us. Proof-of-stake systems like Ethereum, Terra, and Solana allow the industry to move away from the hot, loud, and wasteful proof-of-work systems and return back to a cottage industry of individual stakers and individual validators. And that is what we need to make this industry stay decentralized. Individuals must play their part in crypto network validation. And that is what Lido is here to do. Lido makes staking accessible to everyone at the click of a button. By delegating your stake to Lido's network of nodes, you can access the yield offered by proof-of-stake systems and claim your share of the network transaction rewards. Do you have 32 ETH and want to stake it to Ethereum, but running a node sounds intimidating? Or maybe you have less than 32 ETH and you need to pool your ETH with others so you can access staking yields. Lido offers a solution for both. Simply go to Lido.fi, choose which assets you want to stake, and deposit them to the Lido validating network. Lido is working to make sure proof of stake stays as decentralized as possible, and is committed to decentralizing its own validating network to eventually become a completely permissionless protocol. So if you want to stake your ETH, Terra, or Sol and get liquidity on your stake, go to Lido.fi to get started. All right, guys, we are here with Peter Pan. Peter, what's up?
It is a pleasure to be back on Bankless. Well, Layer Zero, I guess.
Layer Zero, no. Well, yeah.
Different series, right? Yeah, yeah, it is. So, you have different like series and focuses. And
totally, yeah. Layer Zero is just basically the Tuesday flavor of Bankless at this point. So yeah, it's the Bankless podcast, but the Layer Zero subcategory, I guess. But yeah, I'm stoked to get you on for longer than just 30 minutes because the only other time we've had you on the show was the 30-minute pre-interview about what it was like to write that before a Bitcoin series, which turned into like an audiobook type podcast.
Yeah. I think, yeah, that was beautiful. Thank you so much for doing that. Yeah.
Dude, thank you for,
it was so weird because yeah, it was like you, like I wrote it and like when I first came to crypto and like no one taught, like some people read it. So it was cool, but no one really like shone a spot, like no one cared about it for pretty much 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Right.
Depths of the 2017 mania, right? So like not necessarily the community that would appreciate a post of that nature.
So the funny thing was that, yeah, this was one of the first things I discovered crypto, started going to workshops, dev workshops in 17. But I think in 2018, I went full time, just like, I want to learn about the space. I want to find a job. I want to do stuff in here. And I started asking questions really on a fundamental basis of like, you know, what is crypto? What is blockchains? What is technology? Like what is cryptography? Who created cryptography? And when I wrote it, it was just like, I wanted to go through the history. I first started talking to crypto people again. I realized I basically didn't shut up about this stuff. And then I think that's when I realized I should write this down. And I think the series was mostly finished, when the time I went to my first ever crypto conference, in May, 2018, that's right. In Toronto for EdCon. I was on a sponsor. It was a sponsored trip. Like some people, Bucky Poobah in Sydney funded me to go on a scholarship to go to the conference. And I didn't know anyone. I didn't have any friends. So in the hashtag EdCon hashtag for the conference, I just posted like, I kept on posting this link of like the 70s intro to history on before Bitcoin. And surprisingly, I had met a few people such as Philip and Chris Seifert, like who were working on BrainBot and I'm Token back then, like just different people I know all the way to today that like actually like came across what I wrote and then like actually read all of it.
because you just tweeted out the link with the hashtag? Just because you spammed
it? Yeah, I barely had any crypto followers or anything. And I just like spamming that hashtag of like, hey, check this out, the history of crypto.
that's hilarious. Not too many people know this, but I kind of have a similar like entrance into crypto for at ETHember 2018. I wrote out some essays that I thought would be interesting and I didn't have a Medium account. I didn't know what a Medium account was at the time. And so I printed out these essays and I was handing them. I literally had a backpack that felt like 20 yeah. pounds of paper and I was handing them out physically to people at ETHDenver 2018.
I think some of the early cypherpunks did that as well. Really? I forgot who it was, but you know, they were handing out the cypherpunk manifesto and paper to people.
Right, but they were doing that in the 80s and 90s, yeah. right? Not, yeah, yeah, not exactly. after yeah, yeah. Medium had been invented.
yeah. That's right. Good point.
Okay. So, the very basic question that I think I'll start with is like, what was your first entrance into crypto? How did crypto land in your life?
Honestly, I think this went back to 2012 and 13 when I was online. I was like doing weird internet things. I was like learning how to like, it's like they were online. They were like weird forums about things such as like, how do you social engineer systems so you can get like free cans of Red Bull, right? Or like, you know, you learn, it's like, it was a whole forum about like, you know, weird tricks in society, like right. in life, sort of. It's like
real life bugs, real life exploits.
Yeah, it's like really, exactly, real life exploits and bugs that was sort of harmless, right? Like, right. how do you get free cans of Red Bull? It's like you message the support being like, oh my God, I've bought 6 cans and there's absolutely nothing in all of them. I would like a replacement, please. Right. Or like, how do you get a small fry at McDonald's for free? Just go when it's busy and ask that they missed it. Right. Like weird little society bugs like this. And that, and one of the forums was like, they were like, you know, it's like, hey, you can earn several dollars a day clicking captures. And, that happened to be a site where you basically like, it was like Bitcoin faucets back in 2012 or 13. And that's where I discovered Bitcoin. I just like for a day or two, I earned like, you know, barely cents just clicking on captures and like getting Bitcoin from different drips and faucets. And I think that's when, and I didn't think too much about it. I was like, this is weird. Why am I doing this? I'm going to stop doing this. This is like a very little benefit to me.
was it because of the money or just because you could?
because it could, I was like fascinated with, I like set up wallets. I was like collecting like mini bits of Satoshis every time. And I just went down different rabbit holes, you know, on the internet like that. So like, you know, I still have the account to today. So it's like today it's like $70 maybe, right? But like
back then, I was about to ask, wow, were you one of those few people that actually kept the private keys of their first Bitcoins they ever got?
Yeah, I actually surprisingly, I don't know how I dug it up, but I remember one day I was just like looking, like, I wonder if like I have anything, and just like searching my email, and yeah, I still have it actually.
Too bad the airdrops aren't really a thing on Bitcoin, because those wallets would have been if they were.
Yeah. yeah. So I learned about it then, didn't care anything about it. I was really like working in mostly like tech startups in Sydney. Mm-hmm. In like 17, 16 and 18 and around that time period. And I sort of got bored of like building Web2, and I think I started exploring again. And you know, I think I started hearing about, like, I think in the early 17, like people talking about investing in Ethereum now, like, you know, and I was like, wait, what's Ethereum? And I learned there was like many different cryptos other than just Bitcoin. Like I heard about like OMG, MadeSafe, like Sia coin. I'm like, what the hell is Gnosis? I'm like, what the hell is all of this? And then that was until basically like watching YouTube shitcoins for like, you know, shitcoin videos for a while, until I think in September, October of 2017, where I went to my first ever crypto workshop, where that Bucky Puba, the legendary dev of Sydney, the godfather of crypto in Sydney, basically he was back then like running 4-hour workshops at a time, several times a week, around like, what is a private key? What is a blockchain network? It's like, what is, you know, what does it look like to run a light node, sync a light node, right? Like, and that's when I went to my first one, I was like, basically, like, it blew my mind. Like, I was like, whoa, that's like, this is way more than just like speculative investments. This is like entire like platform. Like, this is something that was going to be super huge, and just like fell down the rabbit hole pretty hard. Like, I went to every one of the workshops pretty much. Afterwards, and I think that was my entry into crypto.
So there's often, at least for people who come into the Ethereum community, there's like two aha moments. There's the aha moment of like, oh, this crypto thing is for real and is here to stay. And then there's the aha moment is like, oh, this crypto thing is really all becoming encapsulated by Ethereum. Did you have those two aha moments as well? It's not, you definitely had the first, you just described it. Was there an Ethereum aha moment?
To be honest, I was definitely an XRP holder in the beginning. I like bought everything. I bought Litecoin, I bought Monero, I bought XRP. Right. I was like, and I think I showed up to that dev workshop being like, yeah, I'm an investor. Like, they're like, what are you investing in? I'm like, oh, like Ripple's going to be totally like
revolutionary.
Like the future. Yeah. Thank you. And they're like, I sort of now understand why they're looking at me in a weird way.
Right.
And I think over time, like what I just realized that all these really shady people were like hanging around all the other projects, and only really the real developers and builders were hanging around like Ethereum, the Ethereum community. Mm-hmm. So I sort of like naturally like, you know, made that realization of like, oh, this might be the most legitimate one.
Right.
You know,
and the developer that you were talking about who's leading the workshop, when he was talking about private keys and blockchain networks, was he using Ethereum as like the model, or was it more just like technology independent?
No, it was definitely Ethereum. He was showing me ETH like light node syncing. He was showing us how to deploy ERC-20 contract for a remix, you know, and we were using like, you know, I think Ether wallet back then as well. It was like very ETH centric. So yeah.
When you were, you said you got bored with working in Web2 and you work for tech startups. So what were you doing for tech startups? Like what's your like technical skill set before you came into crypto?
I was a UX designer. So I talked to all the users, right? So the last project, like Web2 product I worked on was Cancer Aid. So it was like, basically, it's basically like if you have cancer, you mostly like are guided by treatment plans and you know, based on paper, right? Like, you know, there's no real way to actually like deliver information real time from like yourself to like, you know, clinicians, right? So like the whole life cycle of like getting cancer and like going into remission and like treatment, like it was like chalk and stone basically. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was like, well, I was working in an app that basically collected all the data, fed it to clinicians. And I was a person really understanding, talking to all the cancer patients, clinicians, family members, everyone part of the journey and just like understanding the problem space. This was like very early on with the startup now, still running today. I was the person that talked to everyone, and put details into a doc and distilled them into products and like features and problems and data to biz dev, marketing, and product. And I designed UI, but a lot of it was talking to people.
What about that like behavior or activity? Do you see yourself like recycling skills into this current Web3 crypto world?
I sort of feel like I hadn't, like with community building, I just like, I feel like with community building, that's a lot of what I've done in the last couple of years and still do a lot of today, like at least helping projects think through this. And I would say that a lot of it is just like, I really take a lot from product design and UX design and user research, because I think in product design, right, like you, the heuristic or what you're taught is basically to really focus on user needs and, build empathy with users and customers, right? And I feel like the equivalent of that, of being user, like of having user and product obsession in Web2 is like the Web3 equivalent is probably like being community first and having empathy for community members, right? So I think that it's really the same thing. And like design in general, it's like design is a process, right? Of like, identifying a problem space, ideating solutions, testing it, iterating, getting feedback, right? And with product design, being a UI designer, web designer, or mobile designer, you just basically, you're assigned specific mediums in which you execute design for, right? Whether you're a graphic designer as well, visual designer, motion designer, you have techniques and tools to solve the problem, right? Or create an outcome or create an experience. I feel like with building communities, it's really designing. You're designing an outcome, you're designing an environment, designing a journey for people to go on to reach a certain goal. And instead of wireframes as being the medium which you express the design through, you're doing that through communication, text, storytelling, organizing the layouts of Discords, even to branding, to all these things, and to relationship building. These are your tools, and instead of me looking at Sketch and drawing boxes all day and using drop shadows, it's probably more like people are more of the interface of community building. So this is the analogy I've always had, and whenever I'm stuck, I usually think like, how do I design myself out of a situation or so on?
So this is really interesting, and I'm trying to figure out the right question to ask. So it feels a little bit like social engineering, right? Where with UX, you're trying to optimize towards an outcome. Social engineering has like a very negative connotation, but right? Like
it does. It's very shady connotation. It's like, no, right. It's not good.
Right. But also like almost explicitly, crypto is, we are trying to, we have tools to tinker with incentives. What does that mean? Right. We're tinkering with social dynamics, right? And in the intro to the show, I always say cypherpunks know that the code they write creates social systems or impacts the people that use it, right? And so like when we're designing these communities, like when you're a UX designer, you're trying to just basically ease the frictions to get the outcome that you want, right? Like we have this outcome, we want to make as many users as possible go through the complete process and actually achieve the outcome. With like communities, they're almost like, isn't an outcome because the community needs to define the outcome. All your job is to do is to get people into the community, right? And have the community figure out the outcome.
I think different communities can exist in different ways, right? Like, the way you describe it, like, the community decides the outcome, totally right. But a part of that journey is like helping, like often like times it's like facilitating that discovery of what that community wants.
Creating
clarity, right? Like that is also the process. And once you have some level of clarity, it's like people like, I guess your job is to help people get that, right? Mm-hmm. So in a way, it definitely is very emergent, but there's also something very like operationally rigorous about like once you've like identified what the community wants, you've often also have to help the community get momentum and find make its steps towards that, right? That's why I think oftentimes, like, the moment in which a community really becomes alive is often when, like, you find the community's first win. It's like, you know, there's plenty of groups that come together that want to do things, but they often fizzle away because nothing ever gets done. There's no ownership, right? And oftentimes I feel like the key there between, like, fizzling out and, like, really becoming something special where everyone jumps on and adds on is, like, you know, sparking the first win, the first victory for that group, and making sure that it's a victory that everyone can feel sort of some sense of ownership around, right?
Do you think that, like, so imagine a hypothetical community has come together. There's a decent amount of energy in there, but there's no W's yet. There's no wins, but there's some semblance of shared purpose and reason and goals in some direction as, like, we don't know where our wins are going to be, but they're going to be over here. Like, we're going to go that way, find a W out there.
Right.
Do you think that, like, maybe the actual instantiation of finding that W can actually change the direction of the community? Is like, well, there's 30 degrees of direction that we're going to go. We're actually going to go 30 degrees to the left, and we're also going to go 30 degrees to the right, but we're going forwards. But they actually find the win 30 degrees to the left. And so everyone stops going right. And because the win was over to the left, the win actually dictates the future direction. Have you seen anything like that?
I've seen communities where, yes, it definitely has dictated that. But I feel like the story of Metacultural is the opposite.
Tell me.
A lot of metacultural has been, like, I've always been very organized. So, like, I want to, like, make sure we, like, find wins, structured wins. But it's always, like, I feel like whenever I've tried to guide the community in many ways, it's what I've ended up achieving is more like performing inception into people, being like making sure that, like, you know, it's like, we need to go somewhere. Let's go. I think we're in this direction. And then, like, some people resist. It's sort of the meme doesn't catch on. And I'm like, all right, whatever. And then very naturally, we actually do go somewhere because people are generally aligned with, like, the requirements of where we need to go. And strangely enough, it's like the answer is very emergent, right? And then over time, I realized that, you know, you need enough chaos and noise to exist. You know, like, some, that is actually some, like, you know, a good thing. You want a lot of, you know, friction and, like, bouncing. You want ideas to float in and out. You want there to be collisions of ideas. And that's sort of where, you know, the mempool of ideas. And that's where I think, you know, direction comes from. So, like, I realized instead of, like, forming direction fast, you know, like, one of the things the mentality shifts I went from in terms of making DAO proposals was, like, instead of, like, pointing in a single direction first, I started writing proposals that really just outlined the vision of where we want to go, and then getting alignment there, and then just, like, holding discussions around that vision. And then very naturally, the sort of the actual tactical direction really emerges from some of the members, right? Like, it sort of clicks when the right meme comes abroad, right? And sort of that's how I've learned sort of how to operate.
There seems to be, like, a chicken and an egg discussion here, right? Like, do the visions dictate the wins, or do the wins dictate the visions? And, I mean, it sounds like there's an interaction between those two things. Do you have an opinion on which one's more important?
I don't think sometimes one is important. Like, sometimes a long-term direction is more important than the current short-term focus, but sometimes you need to also run with it. Sort of like, I feel like running communities or fostering communities is a bit like being sort of a DJ. Sort of like, you know, you're like you're mixing tracks that work well with each other. You sort of know what tracks you're putting on, but at the same time, you're reading the room. Mm-hmm. And the next track that you thought was going to be good 20 minutes ago might not be the right track now. Like, you know, but there might still be this overall theme and that you want to, like, mix throughout the night with, right? Like, you have a certain set of song selections, right, that you want to, like, play within. And there's no right answer, but, like, you know, so I think you have to be really present and sort of have your finger on the pulse on making sure you go explore the areas that the community wants to explore. And at certain times, make trade-offs to just, like, push the community in a certain area because it needs to go where it needs to go, right? And I think that is, like, the, you know, like, it's like not too much salt, not too little, just right, just enough, right? So that's a cooking analogy, I guess. So it's like, you know, yeah.
It makes sense, because when you're, I'm not a DJ. I think you are, or at least you very much appreciate people that DJ.
Yeah, I appreciate my warehouse raves and sounds.
Yeah. Okay. So it seems to be like the shared goal behind like a crypto community at large, but like what we're really talking about, sure, crypto communities and a DJ is like, there's an energy, right? There's a vibe that must be sustained. Yeah. And the DJ's job is to sustain the vibe while also directing it, right? Like making sure the vibe stays alive. And same thing with a community, right? Like there's a vibe, and the best thing, the goal of a community is to make that vibe shared by more people, right? So DJs want their music to be listened to by more people. DeFi communities or crypto communities want their community values to be shared and vibed with by more people, and then have that vibe become like stronger and stronger and stronger over time.
Right.
So like it's just like this core energy of like, there's probably other examples as well.
Yeah, no,
we could also like tie into this
perfect
as well. Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is a perfect way to describe it. And yeah. And there's, you know, it's like oftentimes in DAOs, it's like get shit done or have fun or do both. And like you want to have a bunch of mix of both and do things within that's in line with the vibe of a community. Right.
Yeah. And like, there's gotta be some sort of semblance balance between like play and work and play. Right. Cause if you're if everyone in the DAO is working and no one's playing, well, is that really a vibe? But also if everyone's playing and not working, then like the vibe's going to die because like all the economic resources are going to get expended.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
The whole coming like revolution.
This should be a chart. It's like the trade-off of like guys vibing way too
much to work.
Yeah. It's like the future, like NBA, the crypto version of NBA. It's like vibing, working. It's like we gotta find the perfect triangle, like of equality here. You know,
work hard, play hard makes triangles, a good vibe.
Yeah, the conjoined triangles of vibing and working. I don't know.
There's something here. Somebody else take this and run with it. Peter, what was the first like crypto community that you felt aligned with and identified with?
Good question. I would definitely say I came across. Oh, that's right. Yes, this is so. My first crypto conference, like in May of 2018, you know, at EdCon Toronto, the day before the conference started, I went to this event where, you know, like people were talking about EIP zero. It was a, back then, I think the Ethereum community was like basically in a bit of a shit show, like, you know, because the EIP 999 just happened, which is basically this like idea, it's a hard fork, right? Oh, no, it was like, I think Parity's proposal. I'm not sure what it exactly was, but I think it's Parity's proposal to like hard fork Ethereum, but that was shut down because like there was like a Parity multisig hack. Yeah, no, that I think that was right. Yeah. And the funny thing was also EIP 999 backwards is like 666 die. I just remember that like that meme. So yeah, people were talking about EIP zero. I mean, EIP 999. So like, you know, huge contention because like Ethereum hard forked from the DAO and that happened, right? But what about Parity multisig? You know, blah blah blah. Right. So EIP zero was an effort to basically go around the entire Ethereum community, collect feedback on how Ethereum should be governed, what its values were. Right. It was just one of the first attempts to really put this on paper. Right.
And there's a reference to layer zero here somewhere with EIP zero.
Yeah.
It's like the genesis genesis of the culture, right?
That's right. And I think that was an online survey and I was like helping like collate the survey responses together, right, in a Figma board. But that was a meetup like held by the Ethereum magicians that was in charge of like hosting discussion about EIP zero and EIP 999. And I think there was like Justice Steiner, like it was Lane Rettig, like Hudson, I think Griff Green. They were on a couch and there was like some downtown Toronto meetup space. there was like L4 there, like all the people I saw on Twitter, but were like just on all of that, they're like RL in the couch, like talking about this stuff. And I was just like sitting there like this, like little, you know, dumb nut, just like listening in and like trying to keep up. And I think that resonated because they were truly trying to like protect something important, which is like this, like the community around Ethereum, right? And making sure it doesn't like fragment and, you know, making sure governance was sort of conducted in an open fashion. I think that's the first community I really like resonated with. And like Boris Mann was sort of really in the weeds there, helping coordinate everything. And I was trying to do, I couldn't really participate in any of the discussions. So I just like did the dumb, stupid stuff. Like, hey, I cleaned up the GitHub issues. I tagged all the posts, you know, I wrote the notes for this, right? I did things such as like, oh, let's like, don't know anything about the product managers in Ethereum and Web3 back then. So I'm going to do ETH product interviews, right, on everyone, on all the PMs I knew. And at that meetup, I just like remember being like, wow, this is like, it's like such a privilege potentially to like contribute to something so big, right? Mm-hmm. And that was like, left a strong impression. I was like, I want to do important work one day like these people.
Having the Ethereum cat herders as your first community that you came into with is an insanely awesome answer. I was expecting to hear some random community that like died out a few months later.
If I joined today, it'd be like, oh my, hey, I joined this like social token thing. Like, it's like, we're all getting tattoos. You know, like
getting tattoos. There's, yeah, I'm sure there's going to be an organization like that if not already.
Oh, it exists.
Oh,
yeah, no.
Wait, is it the NFT or what is it? Non-fungible?
Yeah, hashtag shout out to Proof of Ink DAO.
Proof of Ink DAO. I have not inquired as to how I get my ink. They're not real tattoos though, right?
No, they're 100% real. There's about like
ERC-721. Oh boy, I'm not sure I'm ready to try that DAO. Okay, hang on. I'm not done with the Ethereum cat herders section.
Yeah.
Why? You hinted to it, but I just want you to unpack and elaborate. Like, why did you decide to commit so much energy to this organization that you just met? Like, what motivated you to do like the basic stuff, even when you couldn't understand the bigger stuff?
To be honest, when I first, I guess, joined the Ethereum, like when I guess it goes back to before Bitcoin, that series tonight. Like I originally would join just so like, I want to like, I knew like, I think late 17 after going through the workshops, I knew that crypto or Web3 and Ethereum was like going to be like, it was the most, I couldn't explain it to someone very coherently. I didn't do anything in it meaningfully, but I knew it was like the first meaningful venture bet, you know, of crypto really, which was like my dedication of time and energy. It was like, I just was so sure that this was going to be a thing. It was like almost undeniable. Like it just felt so obvious. And I was like, it just made sense to get a head start. I had to front run everyone else and like learn about all of this before it became even more complex. And then, you know, that when I went into sort of the history of cryptography and realized this connection to the cypherpunks, I sort of became very inspired by the sacrifices and all the work that people did, you know, back in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And I really, you know, for the first year, at least from the start of my journey into Ethereum, I felt very inspired to like do something meaningful, like do work that would be eventually like recognized somewhere, you know, like in the, like in 50 years later, like my one wish is just like have some piece of work that I've like worked on, just like remembered as like somewhat sort of a building block. Right. Mm-hmm. So like that was very inspiring. And so I felt like this was important, worthy work that like needed to be done and no one else was going to do this, nor could I really contribute in any other fashion. Like, you know, everyone else was back then, everyone was hiring developers, but no one needed like community builders or like comms, like, you know, no, people who can't code effectively, right? Aren't engineers. So I felt like this is the best grunt work I can do and serve this sort of movement, right? So that's what I did.
And so your resume also includes being a very early, if not the earliest member of Metacartel. When did, how far ahead in the story am I skipping ahead here?
So Metacartel, really the formations happened, you know, in September of 2018. That's right.
Okay.
I think, you know, basically MetaConsult originally was a technical working group around a UX solution known as MetaTransactions, hence the name.
Right. Wow. Yes. That is a trip. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Keep going.
Yeah. So in the same EdCon, I believe in Toronto, there was a UX Unconference. And at that UX Unconference, Alex Van der Sand presented Universal Logins, a UX login solution that used gasless voting and multi-sig key management, right? And that was like revolutionary. And like everyone's like, oh my God, this is like the future of UX. We're going to bring mass adoption. You know, mass adoption is like solved. And I guess his technologies, like he outlined, Alex Van der Sand didn't invent MetaTransactions, but he was the first one that really popularized it and then brought it into the minds of everyone, right? And so his video of talking about universal logins spread around, and you know, I think, you know, I started working project that, you know, also wanted to work in the same area as MetaTransactions. And I think the first ever like real life working group that emerged around MetaTransactions was in the first ever ETH Berlin in 2018. I remember very distinctly, almost photographically, like the first meeting of MP, like people from staff from Gnosis, like people in Status, just gathering in the hall of Factory Berlin. You know, just, hey, like we're here, like let's talk about MetaTransactions and how do we stand, what do we need to do? Like standardize the contract interface. Can we create a decentralized MetaTransactions network? And after that event, we started a Telegram group, which is still alive today, which is like the main ecosystem chat for MetaConsult. Like it's sort of just like general news and stuff like that. But, you know, where we started the MetaTransactions working group. And then we thought that was a boring name after a couple of weeks. Well, you know, so we like put up a vote on which name we should name the working group. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, we named it MetaConsult because actually that wasn't the first name we voted on for. The first name was El Cartel de la Meta. I mean, that was like MPs. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just like a weird, it was like at first vote, it won the outstanding vote, but like, it just was not very easy to pronounce. So we're like,
bad meme.
Immediately bad meme. It was like, not even like that long. It was like half a day later, we realized this is bad. Like, right. Let's change it to Meta Cartel. And the one that was voted in was like Meta with a Meta space cartel. And then we're like, no. And then MP was like, no. You put it together, mm-hmm. right? So it's like MetaConsult. And then that's, I guess the meme is like, we're the only ones working on MetaTransactions. It's a cartel of knowledge.
Right. How many people were there in the Telegram chat at the time?
No more than like 17, 20. So we were running the meetings. We were writing meeting notes and we wrote down everyone who attended as well. Mm-hmm. So I think like, you know, we still have the HackMD documents like back then where it's like, I also wrote like a blog post overview of all the problems we were trying to solve, right? And yeah, it was like no more than 20 people trying to work on this back then.
And so that a group of people working on these like problems that we're trying to solve, that reminds me of one of the talks that I listened to at MCon where somebody, it might have been you actually, talked about how Meta Cartel was formed. At least maybe it was the Meta Cartel venture side, trying to fund projects that were solving the problems that Meta Cartel ran into. And so like kind of, linking this back into our discussion about like how a community establishes a vision for itself, it's very, very emergent, but it seems to be like this community just formed around like, hey, there's this technology called Meta Transactions. It can be a huge UX upgrade. Everyone here sees that vision of the huge UX upgrade. So let's form a group around this. And all of a sudden that group turned into a more instantiated community. What was the next steps after putting everyone into a Telegram and like finding a name for the organization? What happened next?
I guess the fun fact was Austin Griffith was the first one to join that Telegram group chat as well.
Oh, really?
Fun trivia. Yeah. I still have the screenshot that's like, after people joined, we like met offline a couple of times, like East San Francisco, where we like hung out, did things. And it was in October, like early October, we had East San Francisco, and that's where the MetaConsult logo came about as well.
For those that don't know, like the Metacartel logo is a chili pepper in a sombrero.
Yeah, that's dancing and a maracas. And it was MP, dictate. And it was Frankie Nines as well, like drawing the thing. And when it came out, I was like, this is awful. Like, I wanted to be a serious, like, research group. I was like, I need a job. I sort of need some credibility. Like, like, you know, I'm like putting effort into this volunteer sort of like, come on. Like, and then like people love the chili logo. And I'm like, really?
Well, at the same time, like Ethereum had his unicorn logo. Were you, maybe you were in the mindset of just like, hey, I need to look professional because that's what this world is about. Is that the mindset?
Yeah. I think I had this mindset of like, I need to look professional because like for us, like I'm getting to the end of the year and I haven't like done anything. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I haven't like, and I like need to like, I'm running out of money. I need a job. Like, I'm like, that was like, like, okay. Yeah. But you know, like I grew to love it over time, but you know, back then I was like, oh God, really? Just like, okay, whatever. I was like disgruntledly like accepted the logo. So that's an example where like, I really wanted to be one thing, but if people loved it, we went with it. Right. So, yeah. And I guess the unique part about the initial seed of Metacartel was that there was a lot of people who joined the community. Like a lot of people that was part of the initial technical working group around user experience weren't like Ethereum OGs. There were definitely some, right? Like really like people who are around like Stefan from Gnosis and people like that. But it was like a lot of new people. And I think that's what like really spiced up the group from the beginning. It was just like people who came in 17, early 18, who just like were application scrubs. Mm-hmm. Like we couldn't work on like base layer stuff. We couldn't work on scaling. We just like wanted to build cool stuff, right? Like for end users. And that's what we cared about. And that I think seeded a lot of the DNA of like Metacartel, which is like, you know, have fun, do things like run it, like sort of run and gun, like, you know, move fast and experiment, which is the opposite of Ethereum back then, which is like, how do we like build the next 1,000 years of Ethereum? You know, how do we, you know, yeah, build all this infrastructure? We just wanted to experiment and move fast. And it was a fairly counterintuitive sort of mindset as well. Like, and that's what actually I think like signaled and attracted all this, all the interesting people that became Metacartel, you know, like, you know, early on.
There's definitely this like generational phenomenon where generations in crypto find themselves. Like they all, like we all got into crypto with the same background. Like here's like the centralized blockchain scam that we all fell for at the same time. And then we found Ethereum, all of us more in the same few months or so. And then everyone finds like commonality in that when they actually got into crypto. Hey guys, in the second half of the show, the story of Metacartel continues. It is an endless story. It's a long-term games story. So the story by definition does not end, but unfortunately we have to break up the podcast to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible.
Gemini is the world's most trusted cryptocurrency exchange. I've been a customer of Gemini since I first got into crypto in 2017, and it's been my main exchange of choice to make my crypto buys and sells. Gemini is available in all 50 states and in over 50 countries worldwide, and on Gemini there are markets for over 30 various different crypto assets, including many of the hot DeFi tokens, and it's one of the few exchanges that has liquid DAI markets. Gemini just launched their Earn program, where you can earn up to 7.4% interest on 26 various crypto assets. If you're tired of paying fees in DeFi, or you don't want to worry about DeFi exploits, but you still want to earn interest on your crypto assets, Gemini Earn is the product for you. Another product I'm stoked to get my hands on is the Gemini Crypto Back Credit Card, which gives you 3% cash back on all of your purchases, but paid to you in your preferred crypto asset. When I get my Gemini credit card, I'm going to make sure that I get my cash back in ETH. So whenever I buy something, I get a little bit of ETH bonus back to me at the same time. You can open up a free account in under 3 minutes at gemini.com/gobankless. And if you trade more than $100 within the first 30 days after sign up, you'll be gifted a free $15 Bitcoin bonus. Check them out at gemini.com/gobankless. The Aave protocol is a decentralized liquidity protocol on Ethereum, which allows users to supply and borrow certain crypto assets. Aave version 2 has a ton of cool features that makes using the Aave protocol even more powerful. With Aave, you can leverage the full power of DeFi Money Legos, yield, and composability all in one application. On Aave, there are a ton of assets that you can supply to the protocol in order to gain yield. And all of those same assets can also be borrowed from the protocol if you have supplied collateral. Here you can see me borrowing 200 USDC against my portfolio of a number of different DeFi tokens in ETH. I'll choose a variable interest rate because it's a lower rate than the stable interest rate option, but I could choose the stable interest rate option if I wanted to lock in that interest rate in permanently. V2 also features the ability for users to swap collateral without having to withdraw their assets, trade them on Uniswap, and then deposit them back into Aave. With Aave, users can do this in one seamless transaction, saving you time and gas costs. Check out the power of Aave at aave.com. That's A-A-V-E.com.
But I just want to keep on going with the story. So MetaCartel formed after an alliance behind like trying to work on meta transactions, came up with a name, came up with a logo. What was the motivational energy to keep this organization like cohered? Was it considered an organization at this point, or were we still kind of in this like, oh yeah, there's like a group of people under this like label? Like take us from the pre-organization to actually an organization.
Yeah.
Time.
Okay, yeah. That's a very good framing. It was like, honestly, because it had like the Chili logo, and I think because that helps much actually, like I'm so thankful like because of that, because like if it was a serious thing, I might have treated it more like a serious thing. But because it had a Chili logo and like it had all these amazingly like smart people crowd around it, and like for some reason it still like gained a lot of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you just like had smart people coming in to like collaborate and solve problems. And but despite that, I just sort of thought of it as a huge joke that got bigger and bigger. Like we like printed out a MetaCartel shirt and like gave it to Alex Vanderstan to wear. And we printed the logo on the wrong side of the shirt. It was backwards. So we like had to make
on purpose?
Like Alex Jennison wear a we made a mistake. It was just like why someone printed shirts and for some reason the logo's on the back. We're like, who the hell did this? You know? And then we wanted to have Alex Jennison wear it, but he's just like, oh yeah, I'll wear it backwards. So yeah, I don't know if you can find it, but in 2018 in Prague, he was giving a talk and he was just totally backward shirt, like just looks weird. And then we were like, oh my God, like Alex Anderson's wearing our shirt, wearing the MetaCartel shirt, you know? And I think then I had I remember the interaction where I was trying to give Joseph Lubin and sitting in the front row, a MetaCartel logo, like sticker. And he's like, what the hell is this? And I just sort of shied away. I didn't explain it. I was just like, look, have it. I'm like, this is enough. We try to solve many transactions over the new, like, I think at Prague is when we made a breakthrough and like, you know, a lot of the main problems are solved around meta transactions. And that's where the gas station network came about, when Tabuki really made this like the design shift, you know. I think in the new years, like early 2019, then like, you know, ETH Denver or whatever, like I wasn't at the ETH Denver, but like, and a lot of the research problems are over. So I felt like, okay, this was like a fun thing. This is done. I didn't even think about it, right? Until I think like, someone was like in the Telegram MetaCartel chat, like, hey, like, where are we meeting up? And this was like for ETH Denver. I'm like, meet up to do what? Mm-hmm. and I guess at that point we had like spent a lot of time together as a group. Like we hosted dinners that we took out whole restaurants out, filled out the whole restaurant. You know, we've like did a lot of research calls offline and online, and it became, I think when the first person volunteered to, you know, like volunteer to run the meetup and fund the meetup and like find sponsors and it all autonomously came together. I think that's when I really started taking MetaCartel very seriously. I was like, wow, this is like, there's now a community here. It is not just me trying to keep it alive, you know? And I think that's when I was like, okay, like I'm going to dedicate this next year. Like I love time boxing initiatives and sprints. Like I'm going to time box one more year or 1 year to purely focus on growing MetaCartel as a community. And I just knew that it was a very valuable hub of people who are very application minded. And I didn't really know where it would go. I like, you know, I talked a lot with Drew Harding and James Young, like back in late 2018 about like, should we create like a dApp development, you know, studio, adventure studio, can we create a dApp incubator? And I think that's where my mind went. It's like, how do we get more dApps? How do we build more dApps? And how do we experiment with more use cases? And it took on a more generalistic sort of focus of like, let's build stuff that's useful. Absolutely did not get that off the ground because we had no credibility. There's no money. There's just anywhere. No track record as well. And really failed to, like, I think we literally try to form a dApp incubator, but we're like, where do we get money? Like, I don't know. Like, do you know? Like, we're just, you know, we're really clueless.
No one has the money. No one has the ether. Yeah, like, $100. Yeah, like, how who's got the money?
We're like, how do we do this thing? Like, I don't know. So we fluffed around for a bit more until I think, and that was also when Moloch DAO was launching. And I think James Young was talking about Moloch DAO to me, yapping his goddamn ear off to me, like, you know, about Moloch DAO, DAOs, coordinate. And I basically like blocked any sentence in my mind of Moloch and DAO in it for like a while until I think I realized that, like, when Moloch DAO made its first grant, and I was like, wow, like, this is the first ever DAO I've ever seen or like existence that is actually like creating real value today. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really like started to perk up and like, oh wow, I want to join this thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously they didn't let me because I was poor and no one knew who I was as well. Right. But you know, that was the moment where I was like, fuck you guys. I'm going to create my own DAO, or like as a joke, just, mm-hmm. It was initially a joke. I had a chat, a call of Cassandra and Amin, like as a debrief of like, why the fuck was I like not allowed to give away my own money and volunteer? It was like, and then they're like, why don't you create your own DAO? Or turn Metacartel into DAO, or launch a DAO from Metacartel. And I was like, great, why not do like a grant style, focus on like a Moloch DAO, but focus on like the application layer.
Right. That's what Metacartel, that was my first impression of Metacartel, is just another Moloch DAO, but it was with a more specific direction of what it wanted to fund. And it was like, it was Moloch DAO for the UX layer. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I spent about a month filled my days up, of course, like 10, 12 calls at a time, just talking to everyone I knew in the space, which is not a lot, and just ask everyone for money to put it into a DAO. And I think that back then that was sort of not exciting, but not exciting enough. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, you know, we announced a DAO and like, you know, but surprisingly, I guess when we announced it more publicly, people really wanted to experiment with DAOs. And I think even more after when like Joseph Lubin and Vitalik and Consensus EF put in like $4-5 million into Moloch DAO, I was like, oh wow, this is happening, right? So, but even then, we could barely scrape together $150,000 by June to launch the thing. Like, it was honestly a dire sort of effort of like, and it was, I guess, like we scraped together maybe 1,500 ETH at the time. It was just like $100 roughly, or even less ETH than that. Oh no, it was definitely less. It was like 900 ETH, 800 ETH. Yeah. We were just like trying to figure this out. We were super scared. We, like, never done a DAO before. It's like, I was like shaking. Like, and we had a first DAO meeting and I was like trembling in my voice. I was like trying to get people to introduce themselves. Right. And I was like, do people want to do stuff now? Like, are people like, do people like this? Like, I just, no frame of reference. Right. I was just like scared and trying to do things.
Going back to some of the things we were talking about at the very beginning of this, is like, it seems to be that Metacartel was definitely a balance of work and play, right? Like, it had this goofy logo, had this kind of funny name. There wasn't really a shared vision or shared direction that was very well defined yet, but the vibes were very strong. It sounded like the one thing that Metacartel had going for it was like really, really good vibes. And then we enter like the whole Moloch DAO phase where, you know, Amin kind of pioneered the whole like making DAOs cool again. And then Metacartel was just like right behind the whole DAO movement. It's like, well, whatever, we still don't know what our organization is going to be about, but we can at least formalize it
into a DAO and kind of go from there. Would you say you were like the lead community organizer or lead community manager of MetaCartel at the time?
I was the lead slave of MetaCartel.
The drummer.
I did everything and anything the community wanted me to do. I was operating at its wish. Mm-hmm. I was an enforcer, right? Like, you know, and to be honest, like now I haven't thought too much about that time period when like just trying to formalize what is MetaCartel and, you know, what it is like as a DAO, right? I was, holy God, pretty shitless scared. I was like, literally did not know what I was doing. I was like, hope this, like, people don't get pissed that I'm like wasting the time. I'm like, it's just like, and when people committed, I'm like, I'm just like, make sure you commit the ETH, right? Like, and the onboarding instruction, like it was basically, I don't know, like it was through Etherscan. Yeah, we got everyone to onboard for Etherscan.
Oh, shit.
You know, for the contract interface there. And we're like, trust me, like this is legit. Like this, it was like a instructions in a Notion doc, and I just like made a CRM being like, just ping everyone to like onboard. And I was like, just a lot of times scared. I was like, yeah, like, you know, like people who committed like 100 ETH and like they were very important commitments. And I was just trying to make sure that like they came through, right? Mm-hmm. But then we got it off and running. And I think, yeah, a lot of those people I knew, a lot of those people reaching out like that wanted to join. And it was a mix of like, people that just, I think, were ready to experiment. Like in hindsight, it was like a very forward thinking, like everyone who sort of pledges of MetaCartel DAO at the start are like doing fascinating things now today. Just like, it was like really like people who wanted to build DAOs and experiment. And they were the first people who took the leap of faith. I felt like with Moloch, it was a lot of ETH whales, but these people with MetaCartel, like we raised a minimum pledge amount to, you know, 10 ETH from 100, right? So it was like a lot more like ordinary people, builders, and like less ETH whales. And you know, that I'm like ever like so thankful to anyone who even pledged anything to that DAO like back then, because like without their leaps of faith, like it would not be like, we would never have done the experiment. Like it was literally people like, you know, just people from the community being like, look, here's 100 ETH, like you're like, yes, experiment, you know, like, and I'm like, thank you, sir. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, like, I really couldn't help them back, you know, and I think that's what I really cherish about the culture of like, let's just do it, like, you know, and yeah, so, and so very, so like eternally thankful to like everyone who like pledged back then and just like, or even retweeted or even supported the thing, like, you know, yeah.
So why did you give a fuck so much? Like if the direction of MetaCartel was undefined and like the vision was unrealized and the direction, like no one really knew what you were doing and you didn't even know where MetaCartel was going. Why did you put so much energy into it? Why did you commit so hard?
Yeah. So in early 2019, I was like, gave myself some leeway of like, okay, let's spend a couple months trying to figure out MetaCartel stuff. We'll commit a year. But to be honest, 2-3 months into the year, when I was trying to failing to get the DAP incubator stuff off the ground, I started looking for jobs again. I was like applying to places for PM roles, comms. Crypto jobs. It was like comms roles, community management roles, like ops roles, anything non-technical. No one would hire me. Like no one would like pick up, like respond to my like application seat. Like no one would. And I was like, I'm so fucked. Like, I'm like, oh my God. Like I'm like getting pretty broke. Like this is, you know, like not good. Like, and I think like the MetaCartel stuff thing was like, when I was rejected and this prospect of like building a DAO, I was like, you know, like there was the decision of like, continue finding a job or like, go continue wandering in the desert and like, just like accept this this possibility that I might just get fully lost and like not come back out alive or well. And I think to do anything really out there and creative, you have to accept the fate this potential fate that you might just get really lost enough and it might not be a good outcome, right? Mm-hmm. So I just like was like, fuck it, you know, there's a chance that like doing the first fork of Moloch was going to be a really big and interesting experiment. This is potentially a chance to like make a mark, right? Like, you know, in the space. And yeah, I just went into it. And I think that's when actually like Binance Tech from Binance X, they were doing fellowships. They had plenty of money back then. So they, I guess they were just funding like cool projects in the space with $15,000, $5,000 a month. So it's like a 3 month thing. And that came in super clutch.
Yeah.
Like I would have that just like funded, like, you know, I got to Berlin, it was super cheap, lots of kebabs. You know, I split the payment, the $15,000 payment, $5,000 payment every month, two free ways, some to Peeve, some to Alex Hoffman, who was working in the DAO back then, some to myself. And just like that was super clutch. And then once we had money in the DAO, I was like, okay, like I was just sort of every now and then like begging for some money, you know, like, hey, here's a, can I have like a couple thousand, like $3,000, $4,000 here and there, like literally like every 2-3 months. This wasn't like a weekly thing. It was like right. 3 months later, I was like, I have no money. Please, I need to go to DEF CON. Like, can I have $5,000? Yeah, people were like, yeah, of course. But to me, I was like just privileged to like walk on the thing. And yeah, and you know, surprisingly, we had we got somewhere, I guess. And I think a lot of the we didn't know what we were doing. We're just like funding different things. Like we funded Kickback, we funded like DAO ideas, right? And I think that's when we started going from just DApps to like thinking more about DAOs. Of like, okay, we have grand DAOs, but what about DAOs that throw parties that sponsor events?
Right.
What about DAOs that are like that are project? How do you turn a project into a DAO? How do we can we take a create a dev shop DAO, right? What about an investment DAO, like an upgraded version of the grants DAO that could actually value capture, right? Like, and that's where I think a lot of metacultural ideas were like, you know, formed. Then was like really discovered, and also questioned like, what is the future we want to build here? Like, why are we so interested in DAOs? And that, and I think in the latter part of 2019, especially when we had an offsite we called MCON Zero, right, which was like 15 of us just like coming to Denver for an offsite after, you know, after Osaka DevCon, we like came together to talk about like, what are the values of Metacultural? What are the visions that we wanted to build like in Web3? And what are we going to stand for? Like, what are we going to work on? And, you know, and that was a very pivotal sort of like moment, sort of time period for Metacultural.
When did you go into that conversation with your own answers, as in what you wanted to see Metacartel turn into?
Absolutely none.
Yeah. You were there to listen?
Absolutely none. Yeah, I was the guy. I was like, let's hang on Denver. And then like, oh, people were like, yeah, let's do it. And I was just, I was like mind blown that like we could get like 15 brilliant people from the internet to meet IRL in Denver. It's just like, that was mind blowing itself. Like, let alone MCON, the recent MCON one, like where like got several hundred people to come together, right? And I think like there was a moment in like our brainstorming sessions and our Airbnb where we're like, what is our vision? And just like super quiet, like no one. And then I think I just like started ranting like without any thought in my mind, like everything's going to be a game. Like, you know, and then people, I'm like, yeah, like, you know, this is like the shared economic layer for like, that will turn everything into a game. Like, you know, you can, like schools will be game, like work will be gamified, right? Like, you know, you'll work in DAOs, like everything will be, we just like started ranting, like it being absurd about the future with what we knew about DAOs, right? Mm-hmm. And we wrote it all down into this thing called the Web3 Manifesto. We should have probably used that as an investment thesis in hindsight as well. You know, we shouldn't have just like wrote it down and do not too much with it. And then we wrote down our values. That was a bit more, you know, there was more clarity there. I think we could put it down, but that was a very spontaneous moment in the middle of that room where we just like sort of really expressed like where we thought the future was going. And like, that was like a strong driving force of like, we want to build this like world that was more equitable, richer, you know, fairer, right? And a place that could benefit more and more, right? And create more and increase less scarcity. You know, so like and yeah, I think that's one of the uniting factors, I think, of Metacultural. It's not only our values and like what we care about, but also like we all generally, I think, are like builders. Like we were like either like not like coders or like product people, like, you know, traditionally it's like everyone who's there is like here to build the future and like of like what Web3 is and like to explore the frontier, right? And none of us there were like really, I think, like we're like in it for the tech, basically, right? That's one way to describe it.
How did you speak about the values in this conversation where you just started ranting and other people were there?
Yeah.
And everyone was sitting in a circle, all trying to come to terms with how they didn't have an identity right. about what this thing was, but everyone realized that they needed one and no one knew what the answer was. How or why did this whole growing the pie attitude or sustainable wealth approach and creating wealth and sharing it, like that's for something I find very, very deep with. And one of the reasons why I'm attracted to the whole meta cartel cohort of individuals is like they know that the cool thing about Web3 and Ethereum is that we have found ways to generate wealth sustainably. And we get to the more we actually share it, the more we actually get to generate. That took me, like, I only kind of discovered that mental model in, like very, very recently. Some of the meta cartel people right. have been talking about this since day one. Can you just talk about how that sort of vision and ethos arose? Who voiced these opinions the loudest? What did they say? Right. How did it come about?
I think that this was from the very, very start of like, Metacartel from the working group days. Like it just made sense that like why are we like talking about like meta transactions in isolated pockets? Let's come together. Like we're much more powerful, smarter, you know, we can get much more done by collaborating. Mm-hmm. And there was just like this collaborative energy, I think, from the very, very, very start. We took that energy to events, like to create events, to we took that energy into everything we did. And I think that really was the driving forces. Like, and then I think like somewhere early along the lines, I knew this African proverb called like, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I just like slapped it somewhere. And everyone's like, yeah, that's like, that's our thing. So I think that was like this random sort of meme that clicked as well, you know? And I think this is where like everyone really carries it, like really has ownership over this. Everyone truly believes it in the bottom of their hearts that this is like the best way to actually conduct ourselves in Web3, to work with each other, right? Like we have Metacultural is like a community of different DAOs and different people. Like we don't have a single DAO anymore, right? So there's just initiatives of Metacultural. And despite that, we all try to support one another's initiatives. We try to, we are like this social fabric that collaborates with events. And, you know, the reason I think we still stick together is because like everyone who's like drawn to it, I genuinely like feel that like we can benefit one another by like actually operating in a very positive sum manner. And just like people curation, I think, was a big focus throughout all of Metacartel too. Just making sure you had very well-natured like individuals who are givers than takers, right? And we looked for other givers in spaces and brought them in. And I think that is like sort of the key, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. and yeah, we've had to remove a few bad apples over the years, only a few, to be honest, but yeah, like I think there's a huge focus on curation and there was this energy at the start as well.
When, if ever, did the conversation about economic sustainability come about? Was ever a moment where it was like, hey guys, like, it's really cool that we give away money, but like you can only give away money for so long until you run out of money, right? Did the conversation of like, how do we make Metacartel economically sustainable ever come about?
Yeah, we did throughout the whole time, but mm-hmm. and I think it was only that, it only got, became more of a talking point when I think like I really started to burn out in like early 2020, just completely burn out. I think like Bailey just got ventured out up and running then, and massive burnout, just like lost all motivation, like wanted to, I was like instantly when I burnt out, like secluded myself from all social media, all communications for like 2 weeks. And I think like, I just like realized what I was doing, like working like literally insane hours. Like it would be, I didn't even count the hours. It's like, this is the only thing I did every day. And I had one day off and I would just be a vegetable for that day. Mm-hmm. And I think like that creative energy that, you sort of like have, the type, the energy that, you know, makes you go wander in a desert aimlessly in search of in search of something interesting to build. Right. That does have a short fuse on it. Like, and you know, if you can't operate in that mode, which I was operating for the last 2 years, then in a sustainable fashion. And I think that's when we started thinking, that's when we started formalizing roles, paid roles. But by then it was sort of like, okay, like I'm like totally like burnt out. I just need space and time.
Right. In hindsight, now that you are where you are, have you gotten more financial capital by working for or with Metacartel or social capital?
That was the thing I realized when I burnt out, that like social capital doesn't put food on the table, doesn't pay for flights, doesn't pay for, you know, you can't fund other people with social, like you can't. I also saw other starving teams and projects that were doing amazing things. Mm-hmm. And I just was totally helpless almost, mm-hmm. like in helping them. And I just felt like terrible. I was like, I literally can't help you. I can reach, I can tweet about you, but you know, I can't actually like put food on the table for you.
Right.
And I think that was like a very, and that experiencing that myself made me realize like, oh wow. Like it, you know, I think I went from very idealistic, like this, let's just experiment, to like, oh wow. Like if we're sort of powerless without any resources and we're not being sustainable and not generating more resources, accumulating more as a community. Right. Mm-hmm. We're sort of powerless, right? And you know, and if we care about others and we want to help others, we have this like responsibility to make sure we are sustainable and that we are actually do like, you know, grow resources and grow leverage, grow ability to help people. And like resources, wealth, governance power, influence, social capital, all of this, I feel like is totally meaningless unless you're able and willing to use that to like benefit others. And like, why else would you like, you know, like that's sort of the mind shift I sort of made. And, mm-hmm. And that's sort of what I think Metacartel turned from like a research house more into like, how do we like make sure like the projects of everyone in Metacartel succeeds? How do we make sure the people individually succeed, both, you know, like from the personal, satisfaction, the personal lives, to like the, you know, financial, to the create, like whatever they wanted to achieve, right? Like that became more of that of a focus. And I think that's sort of been stemming on ever since last year. And we're yet to like re-establish what Metacartel is about, but it's been a lot more of that in the last year or so than just let's experiment for the sake of experimenting. Let's just give out grants and do things without thinking about the long term.
Is that where Metacartel finds itself today, is in search of economic sustainability?
I would say that really falls in the individuals of its members, but I would distill Metacartel like today to the most trustworthy, like I would say, at least personally from my opinion, like I'm trying to make it the most trusted, most good-willed, good-natured list of curated list of people in all of crypto, mm-hmm. right? Like that's a highly curated list. And that's like what it is. It's like, you know, that if you're in presence of Metacartel, you're in good company. Like you're not amongst people who play shitty games. You know, you're going to have a certain level of trust, like automatically the mood's lighter. You're more able to express yourselves and, you know, let your guard down a tiny bit, because you know you're amongst people who share your values, but also you're amongst people who are willing to like protect those values as well, right? And enforce it, and to also like curate for those values, right? And I think that's what we're trying to really consolidate Metacartel more around, you know.
So does that mean that Metacartel is more of a social DAO? Like maybe it's,
I would say so. Yeah,
DAO? Yeah. It's just curated list of good people.
Yeah. And I think the love of curation is not just like you buy token. I think who knows if we're ever going to have a liquid token, but like right now, as the thinking is like, we want to have like the best curation, like the most anal, most like backbreaking level of curation as humanly possible. Multi human factorial vibe checking, and not just like we like this person. It's like we've walked into this person, we've interacted with them over a long period of time. They've shown how they make decisions. They vibe well. They get involved. They lean in. Like this level of like curation and just making sure that like we endorse and we like help the people that are truly these gems that care about the same things we do succeed in any way, shape, or form, right? With the collective leverage that we have.
Right. So when Metacartel's like culture and vision and ethos vibe, if you will, is like you must be a good person, a provably good person, and then also be able to use that goodness for others and have an interest in doing that. When we like that, it's very easy to have a positive sum nature when like everyone is inside of this group with a positive sum nature, helping other people with positive sum natures, helping other people with positive sum natures. And so it's a great way for positive sum natures to rise to the top, right? Like you can actually bootstrap. But historically, people always say like, you know, nice guys finish last, right? Like if you work for others, then others will just take advantage of you and extract that. But if you can actually put up borders around the good people and say like, here, all the good people go in here, and you find yourself with, you won't actually find anyone in Metacartel that's extract only, because by definition, it's a curated list of people that if you give something to them, they give something more back to you, and then you give something more back to someone else.
We celebrate like those that give selflessly. Like it's like we make sure we consciously like chant, acknowledge and like, you know, highlight that. And I guess it's like Metacartel's version of a good person, you know, like a Metacartel good people
self-defined.
Up to your core, you might think we're a bunch of assholes, and that is totally fine. That is okay. But we're like a guild, we're a faction in this space, and we're of a certain flavor. And those that are sort of amongst the core or potentially very well vetted or just endorsed, right, in some way, shape, or form, you know, we'll probably work on something more formalized, but for now it's a bit more like, you know, amorphous and, you know, sort of, I guess like peer vouched. But we want to make sure that like, you know, there's a sort of protection, and not only protection, but like this platform to empower those, right? Like, that give the most, and it's like a social DAO, like in many senses now. Yeah.
I have a very trusting nature, and it's in the past, it's definitely like cost me. I've trusted people that I should not have trusted. This is before crypto. And the last few days in Colorado at MCON, a bunch of all the MCON people, the Metafactory people, went out to where was it? Was it Breckenridge or somewhere in Colorado?
In somewhere to a lake. Mm-hmm. No lake actually, but
well, maybe we'll tell that story. Anyways, like a group of people, they rented out like 6 houses so we could all go hang out with each other in the middle of the Colorado mountainside, and almost everyone brought their backpacks with their laptop and also Ledger in it, and everyone just like tossed down their backpacks into a little like, here, I put your backpacks over there, like dump it over there. And then everyone just like started walking around the hills of Colorado in varying states of sobriety. No one, like everyone knew that everyone else's ledgers and laptops were like right next to each other, and no one gave a flying, like no one cared at all.
That's the first time it's ever come across my mind that like people's ledgers and laptops were all bunched up next to each other in a room, houses that were totally unattended. And
I didn't know 50% of the people there. Like I had, I did not know. I'm not actually in like Metacartel. And so like, there's a bunch of,
you're strangers in the circles now. You're pretty like, you've hung out with like most. Yeah. So like, I actually feel like you don't need to be like part of any specific DAO to be a Metacartel community member nowadays. It's sort of like you show up, it's like, it's like you show up to the, scouts, or I don't know, you show up to some gym a couple of times and now you're regular, I guess.
So are there defined, you are in Metacartel or you are not? Is there anything like actually defined there?
I would say varying degrees, but we need to do a better job. That's why I think, you know, over the Christmas, over the end of this year, we're definitely going to, there's a clear intent to really work on defining those, what those boundaries. And we'll probably, what we'll do is just like initially like come work on a list of 500-600 people who are like, these are the Meta Cartel people to get added, you know, fill out this type form, and this is the person that's a bouncer. And you might gradually decentralize that. Like, you know, we might give everyone a NFT and say, like, you guys, every year, you guys vote on five people who are the gatekeepers and bouncers of this list. Just like keep it super lightweight. Like, you don't need to have voting. Like, you know, curation is done by the best curators. Like, you know, not everyone's the best curator of people. So, and I think most people get that. Like, a lot of the core Meta Cartel has been around for ages. Like, they've always like sort of had suspicions of like, why, like, why is it like many times like very militaristically like run? Like, wait, what? Like, it, you know, there's a lot of dictator memes, even though we're a DAO, and like, but I think over time they trusted the process that, like, you know, you give someone, you delegate someone power, you trust. That is literally a value of Meta Cartel. Trust, like back others, right? Like, place your trust in them, right? They're here for a reason. And you know, you can withdraw that trust anytime if you wanted to. So as long as that's there, you know, go for it. So we're gonna probably formalize that some way, shape, or form, and maybe like, you know, just something like democracy, you know, revisited but unchanged. It's like five people are gatekeepers to remove anyone from the list. Three people need a vote. Three out of five multi-sig signers. I don't know, to add anyone. Two out of five, and just the goal is to not grow that list quickly, but painfully slowly, like, yeah, very appropriately. Announce members every 3 months. This should be a process that lives, you know, in the background.
It sounds
I think, yeah.
It sounds like Meta and Cartel, go ahead. Go ahead, a little lag.
And I think the end goal is like, you know, and we just have this on-chain list of addresses where like, you guys all get priority access to like all these great things. Yeah.
It sounds like Meta Cartel has actually never been wholly defined. Sounds like it's always been a little bit of a, just like a vibe, not a, not a constitution, vibes only. Do you think that like maybe that's actually the optimal path for Meta Cartel is to kind of only be a vibe and not ever have a constitution?
It's a good question. if someone comes up with one and we all vibe, why not? But, you know, I think we've always just done enough
to
just created just enough social infrastructure for the group to be functional and to go where it needs. And beyond that, it's, I think you get like diminishing level returns in terms of how much effort and thinking you put in.
How much meaning do you ascribe to the Meta Cartel name? Like, I know it was kind of created on a whim.
Yeah.
Meta Cartel. Does that mean anything? Or at least to you?
It's definitely a bit numb to me, I think, you know, because it's just like, it's been everywhere. But I think the meaning of it is definitely of a like, it's like chaotic good at its best. It's like a chaotic good nature, like sort of energy, right? And that's the sense I get from it. And when I think about it, when I think about a Meta Cartel, I think about like the standards it's set in the past by, you know, the former members, the members in the past, the prior activities we've done. And it sort of makes me feel like, you know, we should continue, like it's like there's something to live up to, at least in the past, right? So a lot of the work we did, I think in 2019 and 18, it's like, we could probably never replicate ever again. We were in a totally different state of mind, like just focus as well. And with the right people, right, growing together. And then in that sense, you know, it's like a very rich, I feel like it's just this really rich journey and piece of history we've all sort of been able to share, thankfully. You know, and different people keep joining it. I think that's something we want to foster. It's like, it's a journey that everyone adds on and on, you know, like some of the best, most active members, you know, are the new ones oftentimes, right? They bring the energy and the vibe. And I almost feel like, you know, when I'm like working with 1KX and working another DAOs and helping other people form DAOs, like metaculture was like, as like this element of like chaotic good, it's such a, it, because it's so also so amorphous, like it's just sort of very undefined. It's been shifted in what it is over the years. I sort of use it as this like, almost this expression of community, this nature. It's like, we study nature because it's not controlled. It's erratic and it's, you know, emergent. Like, you know, we study how the forest grows, how lightning flashes across the sky, and we look at the patterns. And I feel like what metacartel was this sort of phenomena, which I often reflect upon and try to learn from even years onwards, right? Mm-hmm. Where like, how do you run a community? What went right? And I try to take pieces of that when I was, you know, when I'm like just in, insanely tunnel vision in, you know, because I think you're in a different mode when you're like working on something 100 hours a week, completely broke, and you need to create something, right? You know, you, like you're with your back against the wall. And like, I'm definitely not at that state level or in that state of mind anymore. And I'm trying to like, it's like a fossil, which I'm trying to learn from, right?
Right. It kind of feels like metacartel is like a meme in the sense that like, I remember I worked as at an ICO advisory company in 2017. That was my first crypto job. And like a number of the ICOs that came through the pipeline were like tokenized memes. It was so antithetical, right? Like we're going to take a meme and we're going to tokenize it. Where like you actually can't tokenize a meme. A meme is something literally, if you try and capture it, it goes elsewhere. And I feel like that's why I asked, maybe metacartel's better off with an undefined vision, because if you try and define it, well, whatever metacartel is will actually just route around the definition and it'll turn into something else. Like, great, we informally instantiated metacartel. Well, fuck it, let's spin up a different Telegram and like talk in that one instead. Like, I feel like if you try and capture it, the energy will actually just go elsewhere.
This is a very profound point, actually. It's an amazing point. Like, because like even whatever we do, we're like, I think we're going to call it the meta something or metacartel's thing, not the metacartel, right? That's a meme that will like, we've maybe like instantiated maybe some of the values and the visions that will like be there, but it's almost like, it's like hidden. It's like this been so many blocks now that like, it's just buried in the history of Ethereum and like fossilized by all the hashes, right? And we can do nothing now but to look back and learn at what those transactions meant and then try to interpret those, right? Mm-hmm. And what will happen onwards is other blocks we sort of do make, right?
My vision of metacartel, what the name actually means, like, first you have meta, and crypto people love being meta, right? Like we like zooming out. Crypto, in my opinion, crypto people are kind of tapped in to how the universe works almost better than anyone else, any other cohort of individuals in the world, in the universe. Like crypto people, they connect weird dots and then they get it right, right? And so they understand the world, they understand the universe at a meta level, right? And then the cartel aspect is like, a cartel is like the first early formations of a government, right? Like, what do you get out of a cartel? Cartel comes knocking on the door and says like, hey, we want to offer you guys protection. And then the people responded like, protection from what? And it's like, oh, anything bad from happening, including us, if you don't pay us. That's what a government is, right? Like government's like, hey, like you got to pay your taxes. And if you don't, we'll throw you in jail. Like that's just one's legitimate, one's brand new. We have this nebulous group of people, which as we've discussed, are a group of people with shared vibes, shared values, a positive sum nature with a commitment to help that positive sum nature be bestowed upon other people also in the metacartel. And so while we were walking around the hills of Colorado, I very much felt like if Ethereum and if the values, Ryan said something on the weekly rollup last week that stuck with me. And when it was, when you adopt crypto protocols, you adopt crypto values. And so the idea is that, like, when you take in, when you use Ethereum and you become a part of DAOs and you adopt NFTs, you start to adopt the values that are embedded into these systems, the values of decentralization, the values of everyone is equal, everyone is an admin. And so going back to Meta Cartel, we have this group that is very, very meta, that understands the world at a very deep level and self-selects for people that with a positive sum nature, that hopefully in my mind, it actually is the new, like, society, the new culture, the new genesis of the new culture, right? Because we want to completely rip out the old financial system, inject it with this new financial system. And then as a result of that, really what we're trying to do is we're not just trying to get people to adopt new technologies. We're trying to get people to adopt new values. And so for me, Meta Cartel is like the new social layer zero, right? The new layer zero for not just like crypto, but for the whole rest of the world. And if Meta Cartel can keep on self-selecting for the people that carry the vibe forward and add energy to the vibe, hopefully Meta Cartel blankets the whole entire world with its values, with its vibe, right? Like, and maybe it's way too ambitious to assume that, like, you know, every single person's Ethereum address will be a part of the Meta Cartel. But I do think that more sneakily, will Meta Cartel come to envelop the whole entire world by blanketing the whole entire world with its values?
Wow, that's a profound vision. Yeah, I guess it's weird to see someone else sharing, talking about Meta Cartel like that, because Meta Cartel has just been this like tragic, like hiccups, a series of hiccups and, you know, misadventures, and like somehow we're like stumbling forwards. And then like, now we're here, and it's been, you know, maybe 3 years since Meta Cartel's been around. Like, who knows what we'll be in like 7 years, and Meta Cartel's like 10 years old, right? But I think that's like, I guess one, yeah. And I guess like, who do you want your neighbors to be in crypto, right? Like, how do you want them to be? Like, right? Like, yeah. So, you know, I think like we'll keep doing what we'll keep doing. And, you know, I think this has this insane focus of like, you know, championing and cherishing and appreciating great people, you know, great people who give and play positive sum games. And hopefully, yeah, it leaves the space one person better, I guess. Right. Mm-hmm.
Peter, who are your heroes in the space?
Oh man.
Who are your great people?
This is super hard. I think definitely like Amin Soleimani, like, he's amazing mentor, like, of me, helped me so many ways, from like lending me a couch to the, like, slash bedroom to sleep in his spank house, back in 2019, was like flat broke. I think, he's definitely one, I think, you know, and then I think there's many others, like, you know, like the Odyssey crew, like, you know, Yale, like James Young, all these other people, like, that I'm not mentioning, just like the early Meta Cartel folks, that are like sort of really like shaped how I think. Yeah.
Awesome, Peter. This is a fantastic conversation. Is there any part of this story that I haven't gone down yet?
No, I think this is amazing. Yeah, like, I think we really went through everything, all things Meta Cartel history, right? And we really went into what it was really about. And I think hopefully those who are listening may get a better sense of what we are beneath the events, beneath the memes, beneath the surface layer events you might come across. The reason why we are the way we are, like, you know, why we might even be fairly selective and exclusive in the way we operate in many ways. And so, yeah.
What's the biggest lesson you've learned in crypto that you think would be relevant for listeners to hear?
I think Meta Cartel would have never, I think, like, been this so important to me if I didn't like take a leap of faith and just like, fuck it. and you know, like, just the, like, I think, like, to be willing to just wander and be lost, like with something that I felt was important, right? So I feel like, you know, if you feel like something's super important, you don't know where it will take you, But you believe it's an important cause and mission. And I would say, yeah, like, and there's this huge ominous sense of unknown, like, go for it. Like, this is like, back yourself and something interesting will happen.
Mm-hmm. When you use the wandering in the desert metaphor, like, you're out there broke, wandering in the desert, trying to find something. Did you actually find something, or did you actually just make a settlement yourself out of this piece of the desert? And then that settlement actually ended up working out. Which do you think is more accurate?
I don't know. Yeah. It's more like, you know, I made enough noise to attract a village, and then that village now sustains who I am, mm-hmm. in many ways, right? Like, it's like, it's funny because I'm like almost the delinquent of the village or city that is Metaconsole, and I'm like, they're taking care of me now. Like, it's like, you know, I'm like, I'm lost. I need a car, you know, back to, from the mountains to mm-hmm. Denver. I'm like, please help. Yeah. Someone please, you know, help do this thing. Or we need a venue, like, these brilliant people stepping up, and mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, just privileged, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Peter, thank you for coming on Layer Zero. This has been a fantastic conversation.
I really appreciate it, David.
Cheers.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed the video. If you did, head over to Bankless HQ right now to develop your crypto investing skills and learn how to free yourself from banks and gain your financial independence. We recommend joining our daily newsletter, podcast, and community as a Bankless Premium subscriber to get the most out of your Bankless experience. You'll get access to our market analysis, our alpha leaks, and exclusive content, and even the Bankless token for airdrops, raffles, and unlocks. If you're interested in crypto, the Bankless community is where you want to be. Click the link in the description to become a Bankless Premium subscriber today. Also, don't forget to subscribe to the channel for in-depth interviews with industry leaders, Ask Me Anythings, and weekly roll-ups where we summarize the week in crypto and other fantastic content. Thanks everyone for watching and being on the journey as we build out the Bankless Nation.